Now we welcome to the studio once again one of my favorite people on the planet Earth. Ethel Ennis is in the studio, known as Baltimore's First Lady of Jazz, one of her First Lady of Jazz anywhere. She is about to do a... She's Ethel just put her head down. This is much too early for Ethel or our other dear guest, Cyrus Chestnut, a world-famous pianist, songwriter, producer, also from Baltimore. Has performed Lincoln Jazz Center Orchestra and so much more, and played with everybody you can imagine, which we'll talk about. They're both awake in the studio, along with Earl Arnett, the husband of Ethel Ennis, and writer and former reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Good to have you all in the studio.
I'm glad to be
good
here.
Morning. Nice to be here.
Good to have you all.
You're really fulfilling WEAA's educational role. I'm going to learn more in the last 5 minutes than ordinarily learn in 2 weeks.
And even though he's not speaking, Henry Wong is in the studio, who owns, of course, the great Omni Musique, which brings in the great blues and jazz and folk performers from across the globe here to Baltimore in a really very unique and gentle setting for all of us to be in. And actually has some decent wine in intermission. So number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump on the Facebook page. So, Cyrus, Ethel, Earl, good to have you on the studio.
I'm glad to be here.
So is this the first time you all have performed together?
How are you going to say that?
How are we going to?
I guess it would probably be the second if you would count the Columbia Big Band as number one.
And that was a few moments ago.
Yeah, it's a few moments ago. Couple ticks of the watch.
I'm listening at you.
So, but you've known each other a while.
Been the person like saying, "Wow, that's Ethel Ennis. Wow."
Right.
You know, for quite a long time, and you know, I always tell a story. I reminded Ethel that when I. You know, I thought it was big time for me being in the Columbia Big Band. And then, lo and behold, there was Ethel Ennis. I was like, wow, you know? And even more special was the fact that she started singing Happy Birthday for the Columbia birthday. And it was like, and she looked at me like, well, what you gonna do? And I was like, okay. And so, you know, that was a beautiful moment.
Since you were waxing about that, let me ask you a question about this, because you're a young man born in the 1960s, right?
Yes.
Right? And as somebody who early on kind of knew that music was where you wanted to be, went to Peabody and studied at Peabody and all the rest through high school, when did you first become aware of Ethel Ennis's music and who she was? How old were you? What did you first hear of her?
Let me see. That's
you don't give me an exact date, but give a general historical moment.
Yes. By the time I got to high school, Beethoven, Brahms, and Mozart had taken the second seat to Bud Powell.
I love it.
Miles Davis and Jimmy Smith. And,
yes, right.
And so in my quest to listen to as much jazz music, because I was really intrigued by it, it had me by the body. Not by the hand, not by the ear. It had
inside.
Me by the body. It had me completely. And so I would kind of start to get into the scene and say, yeah, man, have you checked out Ethel Ennis? I was like, oh, no. I said, well, you need to. And so, you know, it got a chance. I remember there had been times with certain performances, I can't remember specifically, but I would kind of sit in the back and just like, wow, look at that, you know. I was the little young guy, you know, nobody didn't, like I said, what are you trying to do? You know? And so I had to work my way up through the ranks. But I think, and even recently I found out a little bit more which, you know, makes me carry the Baltimore flag even higher, you know.
Amen. I mean, this is, I think, we were counting them up on my website the other day, and this may be the seventh time Ethel's been on the show over the last 20 years, and we have this whole archive of Ethel Ennis that we're really going to do something special with at some point, because this is a part of who we are. How did this collaboration, Ethel, come together for this concert at Andy Musique? What did that begin? Since you've never really done this work together, how did that happen?
Guess what?
What?
Yeah. Well, I celebrated my last birthday at Andé Musique.
I remember that. You were on the show just before that.
Right. And I think that same month or around a few weeks later, Cyrus comes into town.
Mm-hmm.
And we were invited by Henry Wong to attend. And it was just, you know, just wonderful, you know, just listening to Cyrus anyway. I think, was Revelation your very first? Which was your very first recording?
Revelation would be the very first recording. Would have been... Let me hook on my brain.
Okay.
Revelation was the first domestic release.
Your first domestic release.
Yes.
Right.
Because prior to that, there were three records that were done, that were released in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
The Nutman Speaks, The Nutman Speaks Again, and then Another Direction.
They all
come out. So...
Okay.
Well, let me jump in here for a minute and give Henry Wong some due credit,
yes,
because this really was Henry's idea. He has a commitment to Baltimore music, which is rare among producers of music in our town, and he knows that Cyrus and Ethel are really great examples of families that have grown up in Baltimore and made music, and to bring the two of them together, I thought, was a brilliant idea, and that really belongs... The credit belongs to Henry.
Definitely.
Who's here in spirit, but refuses to speak into a microphone for some reason or another.
Don't know why that is. You know? Please don't. And he seems to be in meditation now.
Yes.
Maybe later we can.
And you notice, Henry, it's not me bringing this up.
You know, there is a microphone sitting there.
It is right there.
You know?
Placed there.
But, I think that this is important, because I think that the music scene in Baltimore, in some ways, especially around jazz and the blues and folk tradition that comes to this town, is always underplayed and kind of too hidden at times. And Henry Wong has done this incredible job at Andy Musique, transitioning from his music store in Towson to the music store and this venue, mm-hmm, on Charles Street that brings this kind of stuff to Baltimore.
That's right.
You don't hear anywhere else. And you can sit in these really comfortable, I don't know what it would be called, we call them Victorian kind of chairs, as you, mm-hmm, sit in these rows, and it's a very cool space, you know? And
it is. It's, I think Henry says it's like kind of coming, you know, you get to play in your living room, so to speak.
Yeah, right, mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, what you're hearing out of me right now is Minor Funk. Cyrus Chestnut, a little Minor Funk under us here.
Oh, boy.
So while that play is playing, let me ask this question before I come back to Ethel. The question I want to ask you as well. Where did Nutman come from? I know even that's a mean time show, but where did the Nutman come from?
Well, in the late 80s and like in the 90s, in the beginning of the quote-unquote Wintonian era, if I could say that. Everybody on the scene was given nicknames. Kenny Kirkland was called Doc Tone. Winton was called Skane. Branford was called Steeplone. Everybody had names. Charnette Moffat was called Net Man. And so therefore, here comes I, and a drummer, Carl Ellens, said, well, you know, we got a net man, why not a nut man? so
no deeper significance than that.
Yeah.
Yes. Just
so
checking, I'm not sure.
So everybody started calling me a nut man. Like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of stuck.
I like that. When you started Ethel, did those kind of things take place too? You know, with people kind of getting their little riff names like that?
Well, yeah, we had a Popeye and Slide someone, you know, but not as much as what he was mentioning. That's kind of neat. Well, Chestnut, yeah, Nutman. I think it's appropriate.
Yeah. So, you know, it was just one of those things that just kind of stuck, and it's like, okay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's another nickname I'm given too. But it's called Tater for sweet potato pie. There's a story behind that. But do I have time? I can tell
you
real quick.
We'll let you know that you're hearing "I Fall in Love Too Easily" under Simone by Ethel Ennis. That's mm-hmm. what's playing. We're gonna play little pieces as we're having this conversation.
All
that's
right.
Pretty, yeah. Tell the story.
I was in the studio with Freddie Cole and Grover Washington. Grover Washington was a master baker.
Really?
And he made this, you know, shut your mouth sweet potato pie.
Whoa.
He brought it in, and we were at the Hit Factory, and so everybody got a slice, and then there was one slice left. And I was looking at that joker real hard. So Freddie says, all right. He says, all right, Chestnut, if you can go out there and make this take, on the first, you can have it. So you know what happened.
Mm.
You know, went out there, nailed it on the first. So Freddie Cole, he was like, "All right, Tater." And, you know, only few people, you know, use that one. You know, because that's. You know, but Nutman is kind of the, I guess, the more popular one. But you know,
Nutman and Tater.
Yeah. Yeah, but I still like Cyrus, if you ask me.
Okay.
Cyrus is a storied name from the great Emperor Cyrus himself, the Cyrus Chestnut, right?
I suppose.
In a serious vein, I'm curious what you all, as I'm listening to a lot of pieces that you two have both penned and played and sang over the years. Jazz is this musical form in America that really has changed American music. It's America's classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Comes out of a special world and is still in some ways so subterranean. Do you know what I mean? In terms of the due it's given, in terms of where it's placed on the marquee.
I wonder why.
let us wonder why. What do you
mean? Oh, that has all to do with where this music comes from.
Yeah, we can sit for quite a while talking about that, I'm sure.
I mean, let me just push that a little further, which we were all just alluding to. I mean, you have jazz, which is in some ways a music that is felt very deeply, but is also an intellectual music, in a sense, for want of a better term at the moment, because of the work it takes to write it, create it, think it through, the riffs that come out of what's created as an improv. So, you know, I mean, soul, blues, hip-hop have taken America by a popular storm. And also comes out of the African-American world that defines America. So what do you think the difference is? What do you think it is about jazz that makes it more difficult or not as easy for... easy is not the right word, but that hasn't allowed... We haven't allowed it to become what it is, what it truly is.
Well, I...
Go ahead.
No. I defer.
No, I was just going to say everybody's putting their thinking caps on
Sorry for
that question.
I think you alluded to it earlier. In many ways, I think jazz is still viewed in America as that stepchild. And when America finally allows the stepchild, embraces the stepchild truly, you know, then things happen. things could be a lot different, I think.
One of the things, we have to take a break here, but there was a conductor who will remain nameless, one of whom I will name, Yuri Temirkanov, who was in love with jazz, and I took him to jazz clubs here in town because he fell in love with jazz when he was listening to Voice of America as a young kid in the Soviet Union. There was another conductor who I won't mention, doesn't conduct orchestra in Baltimore now anymore, but one said, I don't get jazz. It just doesn't do anything for me. I want to explore that when I come back. In terms of your lives and the work, we're going to take a quick break when I come right back. Cyrus Chestnut, Ethel Ennis, and of course, the man himself, Earl Annette, in the studio. We'll be right back.
No question in my mind. When you're around, you have a way to make me say.
Soul Brother Cool, Soul Brother. One of my favorite works by Cyrus Chestnut. Play a little bit. He's in the studio here with Ethel Ennis. They're going to be playing together this weekend, which is sold out now, we understand. But there might be standbys. You can check that out. They'll be playing this weekend at Andy Musique. Earl Arnette, husband, partner, journalist, is with us too. You two have been together for, what is it now, 50 years?
Well, we've been married 46 years.
46 years. Mm-hmm. But together for a little bit longer than that.
A little bit longer, although we had a very whirlwind courtship.
That's right, whirlwind courtship.
We met in March of 67 and got married in August. So,
that's right, right.
We just liked each other.
And still do.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's something that we talked about, the secret of relationships. You two waxed forth about that when we were at the end of last. During the break, Henry Wong, we were all talking about what the jazz was saying, and since we can't kind of pry Henry to this microphone, Cyrus is trying hard.
You say, please, please.
Well, Henry has special perspectives on some of American music we call jazz, and that you were asking about that earlier.
Right.
You know? And Henry was saying that it really does come from a passion to be free. And when you get jazz players together, they have a chance to be themselves, not to repeat what was composed 100 years ago, but to make living music. One of the reasons that this country has never recognized the way it should be recognized, I think, is this country really has yet to be. We've yet to fulfill our promise. When this music began to be popular in the 20s, people couldn't believe that serious music, profound music, in the same category as, say, some of the European Beethovens and Mozarts, could come from black culture, black faces. They just couldn't accept it. H.L. Mencken, Baltimore's great sort of newspaper sage, said there were two kinds of music, in his opinion, German music and bad music.
Right, right, right.
When he heard jazz, he thought that was just thumping in 4/4 time, and it would be incorporated into some sort of a European orchestral scherzo, and that would be it. Well, obviously, he was wrong, but he didn't see it either, as smart as he was. He couldn't believe that this great music was coming from where it was coming from. It took people like Duke Ellington and others to export it to Europe, and the Europeans got it quicker than Americans, and still do, unfortunately.
I think Henry was saying to a break that we can explore a bit. I'm going to talk about what you said during the break, too, Cyrus. Was that when you have a quartet, a classical quartet, they play together all the time and they do some interpretation, but it's basically the music of the great composer that you're playing, which you have some twists in that. I mean, every quartet kind of stretches a note a little differently than another quartet will stretch a note. But when you're playing jazz, no matter if you're playing a classical riff or a new riff, jazz musicians can come together at any time from different places and play together and on that piece improvise and riff into different places and becomes this creative moment, which is a little bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. And to, I guess to quote the words of Dr. Robert Stone, he remember telling me jazz is about creation and not recreation. I remember walking around Lake Montebello. He said, "Yeah, you know, Youngblood, Miles and Bird, they created, you know." And when you think about it, jazz at its finest, thrives on that spontaneity, being able to spontaneously compose, and that does take a knowledge of rhythm, melody, and harmony.
Cyrus can do that. One of the things they're going to sing at Ande Music is a tune that he and Ethel put together on the spot, and I had a chance to witness that.
Well, he put it together.
And Cyrus heard something and wrote the music down, and Ethel came up with some words. It was creativity on the spot. Mm-hmm. Cyrus is a master at that. He takes mm-hmm. you on journeys. We've always admired mm-hmm. that about his playing.
Yeah, you not only hear, but you feel his music, and his Sweet Hour of Prayer is out of sight.
It is that. Is that coming up Friday, Saturday night as well?
I don't know.
Who knows?
Have to ask them.
I guess this has been put out there now.
No, it is. It is so wonderful. But we'll be doing things. You'll get the same feel, I'm quite sure, from what he's going to do.
Yeah. The most beautiful thing about this weekend is, call it a meeting of generations. And, yeah, I can say it is going to be a meeting of generations mm-hmm. and a meeting of minds and, you know, sitting down and just sharing and trading ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, we have certain templates, but we're not necessarily going to be bound to them.
Right.
At any time. A certain note, a certain riff could take things a whole completely different way. And, you know, it'll be quite exciting. I know it's going to be exciting for me just to be able to interact with, you know, such a great jazz master. And it's my hope that those who are there, you know, experience that. And I'm kind of calling out all vocalists. If you are not there, shame on you.
We're hearing "Show Me a Man" right now under this by Ethel Anderson. How is that? Go ahead, Ethel.
No, you thought that "Show Me a Man." I haven't heard that in centuries.
Wait, so. You are from different generations when it comes to jazz and music, and I'm just a bunch of things popped in my head when you said that, Cyrus. And Ethel, when you really began working in the 60s a lot, mm-hmm. in the 50s, did you?
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was also about spanning generations. The people you played with were, like, especially men, because men mm-hmm. were running the bands, mm-hmm. were men who came from the generation before you.
A lot of them began the early
parts of jazz, right?
True. Like Hank Jones and Kenny Clarke and many. And of course, go ahead.
When you sang with Benny Goodman, you were you and Rowan Hanna were the youngest people in the band. Zoot Sims, Benny Goodman, others, belong to another generation.
And it was so funny because they had a motorcade going to, we were in Holland, and it was a little village. It seemed like they converted a barn, and it was a very large room, a barn-like building for the concert. And we're in the motorcade, and Hannah, I was seated in the same car with Roland Hannah. And the people are lined up alongside each side of the road. And they were going, they was just so happy they're going to have this concert tonight at that little village. And they would say, "Ooh, look at the niggers, look at the niggers." And I said, and it was said. It was said with endearment. They were just so happy.
In Holland.
Yeah.
Well, Holland's this place where they still have that Christmas thing, that blackface thing, whereby it puts on big lips and paints themselves black and... They still got that going on in Holland. Some people in Holland are trying to ban it. And there's a big battle going on at this moment in Holland over that very thing during this holiday season.
Mm.
What do you think, Cyrus?
Yeah, I've seen that in Japan. It was in Madurai. They actually had a whole big shop of little, you know, kind of like little Sambos. And it's like, really? And they had T-shirts and people, you know, they're walking around like, say, yeah, look at me. Like, I don't think that shop is open anymore, but I just have a whole different take on that. Some people might want to celebrate, but I have a whole different ideology toward it. So.
Well, I think that you know, that's the part of the contradictions of the world that we face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that and absolutely not justifying, because that's a problem, but it's part of the contradictions that we face in terms of what is being offered and created. And it was interesting. I was listening to a guy the other day who's the NPR science guy, and I forgot his name, is it Indian American, and he was talking about the unconscious mind and how people take this test, black or white or whatever they are, and the racist concepts are in the unconscious because of what we've inculcated in this world over the last 600 years. You know, it's so deep.
Yes.
To purge that is probably the battle of the century.
Well, that's why we're still becoming. This America has not yet become what it could be.
It hasn't become beautiful yet.
Right. It's on its way. Well, y'all are bringing some beauty to it.
Well, music can do it, I believe. It's a wonderful key to universality.
Jazz does it. Jazz always speaks of freedom and potentiality and individuals expressing themselves. And I think that's one of the reasons this music has survived and is still appreciated. One of the reasons perhaps it's not as appreciated in America as we've been talking about is that we are sort of consumerized. You know,
right.
We are not citizens so much as consumers. And until we become citizens again, this music will never be as appreciated the way it should be.
I agree.
Yeah, I remember, I think my early days of RCA, when I mentioned the word jazz, they said, no, that's sordid. they weren't going to support it, you know. So you know, no, throw that away, you know. So I guess that's why I was singing these Broadway songs. And I had not too much say of what I wanted to sing. I had an A&R person.
Uh-huh. And they told you what you had to sing about this.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. We've talked a bit about this with you, Ethel, but I want you to, we'll do it again, and also to Cyrus, for people just to hear it. And folks, my apologies. I did the very top of the hour. We are open. Lines are open at 410-319-8888. You can write us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, jump on our Facebook page, which I have not looked at, but I will look at. I got so engrossed in talking with Cyrus Chestnut and Ethel Ennis and Earl Arnett here. 410-319-8888. They'll be together playing Cyrus and Ethel Will this weekend at Andy Musique Friday and Saturday night. And you should check with Andy Musique in case seats open up. Seats may open up. If they do, you want to be there. I'm not surprised this jam is just sold out. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But going back to, this is a question I'm sure people get asked a lot, but I think it's important to hear. Your own roots and paths towards music, because you both were very young when you discovered that this was part of who you are. But my guess is because of the generational difference, maybe not, the paths came... What pulled you in? What pulled your heart and soul into this before your intellect kicked in as well? Ethel, you started in church? No.
I went to church. No, I went to church. I used to play for the Sunday school.
Right, that's what you told us before. Correct. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and then I would sub for my mother when she was, you know, not feeling well. But the church was very, significant in my music life. And I used to, you know, hear the organ playing and it would make you feel like you're going to be a better person the next day and all that. You know, you get that wonderful feeling. But no, that's how I started in church. But Cyrus did a little more in church.
You were playing at 6 years old in church, the Calvary Baptist Church, right?
Yeah, the Mount Calvary Star Baptist Church.
Right.
Yeah, you know. But I too played in the Sunday school as well.
Okay.
My very first job was being the musician for the Israel Baptist Church Sunday School.
Uh-huh.
The interesting thing about playing in church, and I say this often, is that I got a head start on a lot of principles of music. I learned how to accompany people, learn how to accompany while in church.
Mm-hmm.
I learned improvisation in church. I got ear training in church. You know, some people would just get up and start singing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, you had to find them and sometimes chase them, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so when I got to the Peabody Preparatory, there were certain things I already had together in a certain way. Creativity has been something that I guess that met me when it started to play. Even when I was studying at the preparatory, I was taking musicianship courses, of which I had to create. We would study Gregorian chants, music of all the periods of music, and our assignments. Cindy Harcum, I remember her name was Cindy Brackville at the time. You know, she would kick my posterior, boy. Ooh, goodness. But we had to write pieces based on what we studied. So I was always put in a position of creating, going back to church, you know. There was hymn books, and at the Israel Church, Dr. Edmund Mead, at the time, he pulled me aside, put a hymn book in front of me, said, play. And I kind of tiptoed through it. And he said, son, if you want to do anything about this music, you want to learn anything about this music, you better learn how to play them notes. So you know, learn to play the notes. But then there were times where the pastor would just say, just play something. And so it was no time to flip through the book. It's like play something meant play something. You know, accompany the choir, accompany the preacher in closing. You know, it required all that's things that I learned. And I carry even to this day.
You can hear this, Mark, in Cyrus's music. It's a very original blend of that church root with many other things on top of it and blended with it. It makes, you can see why, I think Ahmet Erdogan, the great founder of Atlantic Records,
heard
Cyrus and signed him to, that may have been his first national recording contract, but...
Right.
He heard that kind of essence in Cyrus, this unusual blend. That happens in Baltimore sometimes.
And what we're hearing now is your rendition of Lift Every Voice and Sing.
I'm just listening to it. It is so wonderful. And I told Cyrus, I love the way he makes me weep.
Oh, boy. thank you. You know, about Baltimore, that, you know, call it something in the water, but on the music scene, musicians, artists from Baltimore carry heavy weight around the globe. For those who do know, mm-hmm. I'm happy to say, and I was just saying, Tuesday, I was proud to be a part of Baltimore's musical history. You go to New York and he says, yeah, man, where you from? He says, I'm from Baltimore. Oh, you from Baltimore, huh? Oh, you one of them cats. Oh, okay. You get seen in a whole different light. And
That's interesting.
I'm happy. Mm. I'm happy to be able to carry that, you know. Because some people, like, say, oh, you're from Baltimore. Oh, you know about that show, The Wire. I'm like, yo, yeah, right. But, you know, there's a rich musical heritage here. There's a rich tradition in the arts. you know, and it's deep. It's deep. Some of us made it out, but, you know, there's still some deep people here in this city. You know?
And, you know, one of the beautiful things about, I think, here, just as a side piece, on TNWEA, the Brew, our morning show, they have some of the greatest kind of local musicians, people who have made it out of Baltimore, those who just are dedicated and they're here to Baltimore. They feature them every week and every day on great jazz musicians coming out here, which I think is just a real treat that that Robert and Carla bring us every day. So I think that's a good thing.
Henry Wong belongs to that group of people who understand the city's deep musical roots, and that's what he's been doing at Ande Music. Like I say, he's the one who brought these two remarkable people together
for this weekend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a minute about. We do have some calls coming in. I apologize, I'm not getting to you, but get these calls. But I just get so strung out here talking a bit. But this, in terms of the world of jazz and more, there's always been this particular love affair between the piano and the voice. I guess maybe the guitar is another one, but of all instruments, there's this marriage between the two.
Well, in Cyrus's case, he is the orchestra. It doesn't matter where you're going, he's going to be there. It's almost like he knows how to... Now, this is personal. I'm answering your question kind of strangely, but it's almost like he understands when you should be nude or clothed.
Hmm.
How you like that?
I like that.
Wow.
Yeah, he knows how to leave you alone and you're bare.
Right.
And then... he might hear something. I better clothe him, you know, put something on, you know, and dress you that way. So, it's just wonderful. With the piano, he can be percussive. He can be. Oh, and it was so funny because I didn't want Henry to know that I was going to try to sing this Chinese song. He has done so much for us, you know, in the music in Baltimore. And I said, well, I got to, you know, reciprocate. So I said, okay, I'm going to try to learn this song again that I learned in 88. And I did perform the song in Xiamen, China. And I think it was well received, but I tried. And I'm going to try again this weekend. But I was explaining to Cyrus, I said, now, this first line is about blue skies and clouds. Well, honey, he went there and there was blue sky and clouds. You just tell him and he paints it.
Yeah.
And that you can't get better than that. Just explain what you want and you get it. Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh, Lord, you're putting the pressure on now.
You better have your paintbrushes ready.
Yeah. Oh, boy. You know, it is said that for the vocalist, the pianist, or the choral instrument is kind of the heart, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point of that's kind of like the foundation. And so some people would run from vocalists, or that other word, singers.
Yeah, right. You know? That comes almost derisive in some people's mouths, right?
You know, right. But I always run toward the vocalists because, one, they have such an advantage. One, it becomes personal because not only they deal with the melody, but they deal with the lyric and the story behind the song.
Mm-hmm.
And you could sit down at the piano and if you just think about it from just moving your hands and moving your fingers, you know, it could become very very impersonal at all. But you know, when you start, I was like, this part's about blue skies and waterfalls, and the challenge is to figure out how to create that.
Mm-hmm.
How to create that. How can you take this combination of notes, or how can mm-hmm. you use your touch to, you know, to bring that real, to help tell a story? Because ultimately, music, you know, the notes should just simply tell a story. And if you're not sharing a story, then it's just an exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No. And I guess it has to be a combination in some ways. I was just thinking, as you were talking about this, Cyrus, and it's for both of you, really, that it's a combination of, in your case, out of the voice, in your case, the hands, but also the feeling you have internally that's almost indescribable, mm-hmm. and how that connects to your music intellectuality, thinking about how the and how those things fit together.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, how they become one.
Yeah, yes, and a good accompanist always listens.
Mm.
A good accompanist mm-hmm. always listens. Mm-hmm. You know, you can. You have to, in order to know what to do, you got to check out what's going on.
And the same for the singer. I mean, you have to kind of hear the riffs.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, there's the conversation going on. It's
right.
It's like that. You know, it's hand in glove.
Because yeah, it is. That's exactly what it is. It's mm-hmm. this conversation. You have to be able to listen, because we lose in conversation. We lose the art of listening
mm-hmm.
often, mm-hmm. and you can't do this without the art of listening.
Absolutely,
that's right.
Absolutely, absolutely. And from that, from the work with the vocalist, when you go into in a more instrumental setting, you can still apply all of that, you know, all of the passion, all of the intimacy, the need to tell a story. And
yeah.
It's not only, you know, sometimes you can get so lost in just quarter notes, 16th notes, and 18th, and eighth notes, you know. But when you really start to just look at music, though, I think notes and chords are just gateways to the true story. That's what you were trying to sell to, that trying to make that them. Oh, I'm
no,
tied.
Cool.
Yeah.
So,
oh.
It'll be better on Saturday and Friday.
Sure.
I'm just teasing, Cyrus. I'm just teasing.
But just trying to really tell that story to send someone away feeling better
mm-hmm.
than when they arrived.
Right.
And we are just about out of time here talking about sending people away. And we can get a quick, can we go run this quick call? Sherman, we have maybe you're on the air. We have 60 seconds to say what you have to say, then we've got to roll. Sherman.
Yes?
We have about 60 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. Hello, Ethel. How are you?
I'm doing fine, I think.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Ethel, I'm a person that knew you when you were in the Gilmore, when you were living in the Gilmore Project.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And I remember you had a young brother there, and he grew up.
Andy, yeah, Andrew.
And the horn.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally, I believe it was Duke Ellum Band that he got to, right?
Ray Charles. Yeah, he first was Bill Doggett, and then he went with Ray Charles.
Ray Charles, okay. Now, when you first met me...
Sherman, we only have like 30 seconds. I'm sorry, so you have to make that fast. I'm sorry, brother.
Okay. You could not drive a car.
Oh, okay. What happened?
I gave you your first driving lesson in my 53 Buick.
Oh, my goodness.
Lord. Well, maybe you should hold on. We need to get your number to get some more stories from you, Sherman. Do not hang up. My producer's there to pick up and get your number. We're going to get these stories.
Okay.
Ethel Ennis, Cyrus Chestnut, Earl Annette, thank you all so much for being in the studio today.
Wonderful. It's always been great. Honor.
Henry Wong, thank you for coming in as well.
You.
For the inspiration just being there to have you. And tonight, tomorrow night and Saturday night at Andy mm-hmm. Musique, we'll have all the information on our website. If with any luck, some people will drop out, and you'll be able to drop in and get a ticket to hear this incredible night. We'll be there tomorrow night. We're looking forward to it. Thank you all so much for what you bring to all of us.
Well, we thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break, and when we return, we will kind of switch gears, and we're going to talk about, we come back with Charles Johnson, don't we? And this incredible new children's book this great philosopher and thinker wrote with his daughter. You're going to love this. A wonderful young black superhero takes on the world in many interesting ways. Don't go away.